Today in Movie Wallace, we talk about Can You Ever Forgive Me? The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Widows. For Movie Wallahs, hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And yes, Jess Well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news, and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming, or on the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Hello's.
Hello.
Greetings, all.
It's Thanksgiving weekend.
And we are very, very thankful. Yes.
Yes, indeed, we are. For many things, actually, including this podcast.
Yes. And the delicious cake we just ate.
Yes.
Nothing Bundt cakes.
That's B-U-N-T-D. No,
B-U-N-D-T. Bundt.
Bundt.
Nothing Bundt cakes.
Yes.
Mm.
Which are good.
San Diego. Are they San Diego or are they national?
I know
that there's a couple around here, but they have those classic Bundt shape cake, which is the circular cake with a hole in it.
Delicious.
Why are they called Bundt cakes? Does anyone know why they're called Bundt cakes?
I think the pan in which they're made is a Bundt pan.
But I don't know why it's called a Bundt pan, because that's going to be Joe's next question,
German.
I can tell.
Yeah, it's some kind of German device. Yeah.
Very nice. Well, I've still got my cake here. You guys have scoffed yours.
Jealously.
It's actually a very tasty cake.
Yeah.
It's moist.
That's what I love about them. They're kind of like cupcakes, but they're more delicious. Because they have a cream cheese frosting too.
Is that the buntness of them?
Why
would you cook a cake in a Bundt tin?
So you can fill it with something in the space that remains.
Oh,
yeah. And you get more surface area. It's a ring.
Anyway, this is not Cake Wallace.
That's right.
Although we do enjoy our cake. So I suppose we ought to get on with things today,
yes,
because we do have three movies to talk about.
I'll talk about the next podcast.
I'll skip. Coming to a podcast near you, discussion of MoviePass versus AMC Stubbs A-List. We'll talk about that maybe next podcast.
Okay.
So... three movies. Can You Ever Forgive Me? The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Widows. Yeah, no, you sound like Rashmi. which one would you like to begin
Let's
with?
Let's start with Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Okay. So I think, Rashmi, you're going to tell us about this one?
No, yes, he is, I think.
Okay, I've got the Ballad of Buster
Scruggs. Oh, no, mate, it's Joe.
I had the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. See, top quality production here on Movie Wallahs. We've got no clue what we're doing, as always.
Yeah, I can do it.
Okay, I'll do both. Why not?
No, because he's already down to do Buster Scruggs and he's prepared.
You told me
Buster Scruggs. Unlike you, Joe. But I can forgive you.
Okay, so which one am I doing?
Can you ever forgive me?
Okay. So this is the latest. This is kind of an interesting movie. They've been promoting it. It feels like almost the entire year. It felt very much like it was Melissa McCarthy's, big push this year for award recognition. It's written and directed by Marielle Heller, who we know from Diary of a Teenage Girl, which Rashmi and I watched a couple of years ago.
LA Film Festival.
And I remember that movie had quite an impact on me. I felt it never really reached commercial success. People didn't know much about it, but that was a terrific movie with Belle Powley. This movie is essentially the true story of the... writer, author Lee Israel, who basically made a living in the 1970s and 80s when she kind of fell into some hard times. She ended up turning herself towards criminality through the forgery of various notes of people of note, famous authors, etc., from the past. And the movie itself stars Melissa McCarthy, Richard E. Grant as the primary. We have Ben Falcone, who's always opposite Melissa McCarthy, Dolly Wells, Jane Curtin, Anna Deavere Smith. These are all the Rotten Tomatoes folks. So I butchered that slightly, but regardless, what did you guys think of Can You Ever Forgive Me?
Okay, so for me, this is yet another example this year of an impeccable performance in an average middling movie overall. And I think it's a great vehicle, as you said, Joe, for Melissa McCarthy to show off her acting chops. But overall, I found the pacing a little bit slow and dull. It's an enjoyable movie in the moment. I just feel like her performance outweighed the story that we were being told.
I liked it a lot. I think we don't often see movies which are that misanthropic or have characters who are that curmudgeonly. We see a lot of that in foreign films, but we don't see it as much. I think people are afraid to make movies about characters who are...
mean-spirited,
unlikable and unapologetically unlikable. And I think, you know, Melissa McCarthy can laugh her way to the bank, you know, for decades. You know, she can do the kind of shtick she does in her sleep. And I can sense that she's probably getting tired of doing the same thing, you know, putting on different wigs and, you know, and she does that very well. I mean, she can keep doing it. But I think it's kind of interesting that she took on this character or took on this movie, which is, you know, a very small movie by any standards, playing a character who is so real, so identifiable. And it says a lot about, it has a lot to say about gender politics. It has a lot to say about the publishing world in the 90s. It has a lot to say about when do you cross over into criminality with the best of intentions and how that's not, you know, one fine day you don't decide to do something bad. It just happens over a period of time. And it kind of speaks to this push and pull you have between doing something that you enjoy and that's beneficial versus acknowledging that it's wrong. It's morally wrong. So I really enjoyed the movie, and I like that at the center of this movie is this relationship between two people who are misfits in the New York community. They're both artists. And there is kind of a hard-won sweetness about the relationship between the Melissa McCarthy character and the Richard E. Grant character. I don't know. I like this movie, and I can see why Marielle Heller is such a good filmmaker, because in each instance she's kind of doing a story set not in a contemporary time, but is able to fill in the gaps around those characters so beautifully. In the case of her first movie, where all the characters around the Diary of a
Teenage girl.
Mm-hmm. All the characters around her were so fully well fleshed. And here as well, I really got a sense of a time and a place. So I really liked it.
Good, yeah. I did too. I think clearly Melissa McCarthy put a lot into this role. And maybe I say that because I'm so used to the clown side of Melissa McCarthy, mm-hmm. where she's got excellent comedic timing. But this, to me, felt like the actress that she has always wanted to be, kind of thing. She plays very few serious roles, and I think she's very well suited to this type of intense person. And it's really hard for me to say that she was genuinely dislikable when Melissa McCarthy herself is such an agreeable screen presence. So the movie itself again worked very well as it had the right level of tension for the kind of trouble that she was increasing herself. It had that very tight feeling of increasing dread as the lies got bigger, as the deception got bigger, as things started to unravel and the walls started closing in. So I kind of really enjoyed that aspect of it. But yeah, you're right, Yesti. I mean, the central part of the movie with the relationship between Melissa McCarthy character and the Richard E. Grant character and the dysfunction of that was done very well. So, yeah, I agree. I think, once again, Marielle Heller creates a very believable situation and one that's not necessarily comfortable for us to be in.
Yes, it's interesting that you both bring up the relationship with Richard E. Grant character. That's actually the thing that I had the problem with, because I found his character to be such a caricature that I couldn't buy into it. And then I didn't understand the speed at which that relationship came to fruition. Like, I didn't believe that that character, curmudgeonly and angry and bitter as she was, would have that type of relationship with the Richard E. Grant character. So I couldn't buy into that whole storyline of their friendship. So I found that very grinding. I almost cringed every time he came on screen, because it was such a caricature of an older gay gentleman, you know, into the arts. I just thought, really? You're going to play it like this? I wish that it had been more of a subtle performance, but I understand why there may have been a decision to make him so sparkly, because she was so curmudgeonly. And to your point, Joe, it's not often that we get movies that where the central character is unlikable. And so I almost feel like the Richard E. Grant character had to be larger than life to compensate for how we weren't feeling about the Melissa McCarthy character. But that's the central problem that I had.
I see what you mean. I mean, he plays a very flamboyant character. But I'd never got a sense that he kind of crossed the line into being a caricature or unrealistic. He seemed realistic to me. And I think he had enough nuance to him. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, they were both kind of not willing to accept their friendship. And they kind of did what they thought was right for each of them. And there were betrayals. And I think, again, this is based on a real story.
Yeah.
So I think there's some truth to... I mean, I know people like that who are, you know, good in their heart. But they are just... They can't help their tongues. They're so curmudgeonly that they destroy the relationships of those who are close, yes, to them. They destroy the relationships of those...
No names will be mentioned.
No names will be mentioned, but they...
Joseph.
No, not Joe. No. But, you know, they destroy everything. And in a way, they have chosen to live the world by their terms at any cost. And there's some degree of bravery in that, I guess, to saying, I'm not going to change for the world. The world can take me as I am.
Yeah.
And either, you know, eat, yeah, me up and spit me out, or, you know, I will prevail. So I think, again, it's very rare that you see a character like that. And to the movie's great credit, it never tries to kind of soften her character or make her... you know, suddenly have a conscience or any of those things. I think she does go to a point where she realizes that she has crossed that line. But no, I mean, I just appreciated it because we don't see too many movies like this. And, you know, Nicole Holofcener, who is a wonderful director by her own means, she has co-written the book based on the biography of Lee Israel, you know, who did this. So I actually found the script very good. And, you know, there's some very interesting dynamic between Melissa McCarthy and her ex-lover. There's a very interesting dynamic between Melissa McCarthy and this bookseller.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's very specific to that time and place and these people. I felt like I was watching a documentary, yeah, in the best way.
Yeah. I was going to say, I mean, I think the movie avoids getting overly dramatic with its dramatic moments. And I think, you know, even for me, which was the kind of where the movie peaked, was, you know, when the crimes are unraveled and the character gets her comeuppance and, you know, she has to have that kind of moment of realization. Even that was handled, you know, very well. I think it was maybe a reflection of the real person, because, you know, this isn't a character. This is somebody who existed, and these events, to some extent, took place. So, you know, the courtroom scene is yeah, kind of what I'm thinking of here, where, yeah, it had a very real feel to the whole thing. So,
sum up. Give us a summary and a score.
That was probably it. 8 out of 10. I think this movie feels it's not unfunny either. I mean, I think there's we talk about the Melissa McCarthy performance here in terms of drama, but the movie has some very good comedic moments. I genuinely laughed. I genuinely cried in some of them. I think the movie hits every note that it intended to hit. So bravo, 8 out of 10.
Nice.
Yes, yeah, an 8 out of 10 for me as well, because I think the history of cinema has been the history of beautiful, attractive, loving, agreeable, pleasant, sensational, sparkly people. And the movie chooses, in most of its characters, none of those people. These are all very real, very flawed, very authentic individuals. And it's based on a real life story. And I, like you, Joe, I kind of felt a sense of like, oh my God, what is the moment where she's going to get caught? Like the walls were really closing in on
yes.
her. So kind of, in spite of all her flaws, I was looking out for her. And I think that's the movie's great success. And excellent performances all around. I really enjoyed this. 8 out of 10.
I made out like Joe that I hated this movie, and I didn't hate it. I was just irritated by that one character. Mm-hmm. I think this is a solid 7. I can forgive the movie because it has a great relationship between Melissa McCarthy and her cat.
Yes.
Which is a very sad plot line.
I know, but I just loved the cat.
Yep.
Yes. And it showed, I think it showed the human side of her that she could connect with her cat.
Yep. Okay. Movie number 2 then. Should we do The Ballad of Buster Scruggs?
Yes, let's do it.
Sure.
So The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is the latest from Ethel and Joan Coen, the Coen brothers, who have in a short place in American cinema as one of the great masters. And this is, I think, their first foray into making a movie that is playing right now on your television screens on Netflix.
Yeah.
I think this is their first. It's interesting how...
It could be a Netflix pick.
Yes, it could be. It's interesting that now it seems like Netflix has... There's no echelon within the film industry that Netflix hasn't built a bridge with. So even the biggest name filmmakers are now making movies with it. The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is in fact an anthology of 6 different stories. The only thing combining them is that they're all set in the old, old West. And in fact, The Ballad of Buster Scruggs is just the title of the very first in those 6 stories. We don't get to see anthology, you know, movies that much, where there are 6 separated stories which don't have anything to do with each other. In fact, remind me, but I was looking to see if any characters from any of the stories could be seen again in any of the other ones, and I did not.
No.
So they're all separate stories. Rumor has it, I recall reading that actually Netflix was trying to convince Joel and Ethan a series.
Oh, interesting.
And then these were all done as separate episodes of a series. And
okay.
Then I don't know what transpired, but they decided to put it all together into a movie. All the good, many of the frequent collaborators that Joel and Ethan Coen work with are in this movie. Tim Blake Nelson plays the title character, Buster Scruggs. We also have David Krumholtz. We have Zoe Kazan, who we love. We have James Franco. We have Stephen Root. We have Liam Neeson. That Liam Neeson. We have Tom Waits. We have, who else did I miss? Oh, yeah, Tyne Daly is here. And Brendan Gleeson, who we all love and adore. He is in this movie as well. So, you know, anytime Joel and Ethan Coen come up with a new movie, it's a cause for celebration. We love everything they do. Is this an exception?
Okay, so if you aren't a fan of the Coen brothers, you aren't going to enjoy this movie, so give it a miss. However, if you are, this is another great entry from the masters of crazy, dark, provocative, funny drama. I love this movie.
The problem with anthologies, I think, is that they can be a hit or miss, depending on whether or not you connect with the story. And I think all of these are very well made, but I think some of them work better than others for me. And I think, for me, given that there is no specific or at least discernible in my mind, a connection between any of the stories other than the setting of the Old West.
Death.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, but I mean, life, you know, I mean, to me, there's this, like, I couldn't kind of put the thing together. I felt like the sequencing was a little off in that the movie started off incredibly strong with the first episode, you know, which was funny, was shocking.
Different.
You know, different. And yeah, the fact that it was, you know, pretty much a ballad. It was a song. It was a poem. It was done in large part musically. And then it kind of took a couple of very interesting turns, but the final, like, one or two, just it lost a little energy for me, and so I found myself struggling to stay as interested as I had been. And maybe that was just the contrast between, you know, the funny, bubbly, poppy, zingy, early stories, and then the lesser ones. But good stuff. I mean, I would quite happily sit there with the pause button and, you know, watch one at a time. If you want to watch it episodically, good stuff.
Yes, Dee.
I loved it. I loved every one of the stories. I was just lapping it up. I was like, okay, what's next? I felt like a kid sitting under a Christmas tree on the morning of Christmas Eve, opening one box after the other, because
it's a great analogy.
They kind of ended unexpectedly, all of them, and like you said earlier, this is very bleak stuff, except for the first one, because they all deal with death and tragedy. And you realize that in the old, old, old Wild West, death was around the corner at any point, right? Either by virtue of nature or by virtue of somebody. It's just like the law of the jungle. You know, people killed each other for the smallest pretext. So that made for a very unpredictable journey. And I've been reading a lot of reviews, and they've been saying exactly what you said, Joe, that it's very uneven, that some stories work better than others. For me, every story worked better than the previous one.
And oh,
the next
interesting.
One was even better. I mean, and I would have struggled how to order them as well.
Yes.
There's only one that I didn't fully get, and I need to kind of watch it again, and I can because it's on Netflix. But I love the writing in this. I loved, there's one bizarre story about this actor in a traveling with the Liam Neeson one.
That was so bizarre.
That is so bizarre. And it's,
but it was very deep.
It's very deep. It's very bizarre. It's surreal.
It's disturbing.
It's disturbing. And I don't know. I enjoyed it. I was happy that the Coen brothers exist, that somebody's making things like that. The very last story about these people in a coach, I could have listened to them for 2 hours. It felt to me like Tarantino-esque, like dialogue of these six people who don't know anything about each other, and they start having a conversation, and the conversation
gets... And it's so unpredictable, and the walls are closing in, and it's...
And these people don't know each other, and as they start talking, they realize they have very, very differing opinions about life, and they start getting...
And it was relevant.
Chafed.
It was relevant to today.
Yeah, it's very relevant to today, how divided we are, and how they're getting... Everybody gets on a high horse about their beliefs. The Zoe Kazan one,
that's
was
the one.
It just broke
that
my
was
heart.
Stand up for me,
I love that one. She and I think it's because she
so
was
good.
So good.
I mean, I would have not in 100 years thought to put Zoe Kazan in a movie about the old, old West, because something about her sensibility is so modern.
She's so LA,
giggly,
yes,
avant-garde, modern, and she totally sinks into this. And I just came out of watching, I know we're not going to discuss this today, but I came out of watching Wildlife yesterday, the movie that Paul Dano has directed with Jake Gyllenhaal and
Carey Mulligan.
Carey Mulligan, thank you. But that movie is executive produced by by Zoe Kazan, and it's co-written by him, by Paul Dano and Zoe Kazan. So I'm even more in awe of what she's doing. They're kind of taking things in their own hands and saying, let me make the movie that I want to make. So
and
anyway,
of course, the two of them, for our listeners...
Are they related?
They were in the first, the movie where he imagines her.
Right, Ruby something.
Ruby Sparks,
yeah. I don't know if they're dating, but...
I don't know, but I know they were in... That was one of the... Like, that's where we noticed both of them. Very early movie. So Ruby Sparks, if you are interested.
So anyway, I just want to say, overall, these stories have a lot to say about death. They have, like, surprises. There is a singing one. There is a bleak one. There is a surreal one. There is a Tarantino-y one. I loved all of it. I could have gone... I can watch another anthology tomorrow.
Me too. I mean, I hope there's more to come. I kept thinking this reminded me, or I enjoyed this as much as one of the other anthologies, which always sticks out in my mind, which was the Argentinian movie called Wild Tales that was out in 2014. And remember, that was an anthology about revenge, which was spectacular. And I haven't seen anything as spectacular as that since this. I'm not sure if this was kind of... things from True Grit that never made it to big screen, or ideas of characters, because even when I look back at True Grit, each one of those characters that only makes an appearance for one scene is so rich. I kind of wondered if they had got so excited with that this had carried over. But again, I mean, I think of the story with like the Franco one, the James Franco one. They're so funny, like the bank heist and everything is hilarious and so dark. I mean, they just get darkness, the comedy of darkness and death. They get it so perfectly.
They have such a unique voice. I mean, yes. I think that's always what kind of surprises me when, I mean, there are some directors, and, you know, I think about this a lot, and we maybe talk about this sometimes, where you just know who's behind the camera by virtue of, you know, a single sentence that's spoken, or a single composition or a single shot.
Yeah.
And their presence is always, always, always felt. I think the knack for kind of bringing out the bizarre humor,
the absurdity of life.
Yes, and death. Yeah. And all of it. It's such a unique voice. You know, I don't know that anyone does it as well as these guys. And so, yeah, I think, I mean, I'm not sure if we're ready to wrap up, but...
You are.
Okay, well, I'll come back. Yes, you were going to say something.
No, and I think, you know, I remember watching, I used to watch American Idol very religiously when it was first coming out. I was, you know, it was one of my favorite TV shows. And I know one time they had, you know, they have different singers that they pick every week that they have to kind of pick a song from and sing. And one time they picked Elton John, and all the singers were like, oh, Elton John, I know 100 songs, that's easy. And everybody bombed. And that's when Simon Cowell said, it's precisely because, you know, Elton John makes it look so easy that everybody realizes it's so difficult to do it. Yeah. And that's exactly the thing with the Coen brothers. It's precisely because everybody keeps trying to copy them, and it always falls flat on their face. I mean,
so true.
It, you know, so there's so many movies.
About, Times at the El Royale, which
I loved. But yes,
I loved too.
Yes,
it's trying to... paying homage to... The Coens, stunning, that style.
Or Suburbicon.
Yeah.
There's so many movies where people try to do it, and it's a very hard thing to pull off.
Yes.
Because it's so dark, and the humor has to be so right, and the craft has to be so good.
And it has to be authentic. And each one of these stories are absurd and real and ridiculous, but they're authentic. Okay, that sounded like a summing up.
Yeah, so I, you know... see it all in one sitting over 2 hours on Netflix, or see them, you know, each 20 or 30 minute episode.
Or watch each one 6 times.
Yeah, you can do that as well. But it's just a joy. I think anything from the Coen brothers is a gift to movie lovers. And you have 6 little gifts here, little packages instead of one big one. I enjoyed every single one of them. We didn't even talk about the one about the prospector, which is played by Tom Waits, the singer Tom Waits. He's so good. And I couldn't watch, because I was like, oh my God, this is just not again. It's like an old, like, biblical fable.
Yes. You know? I even forgot about that one. And I'm just reminded when I'm looking on the screen.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that was such a good story.
Right. So Netflix, you know, get the Coen brothers, ask them to make more. But to all of us, we all have Netflix. You owe yourself to go watch it. A very, very stingy 8 out of 10.
It's the end of the year. It's Thanksgiving.
It's going to be on my list. It's 8.5 out of 10.
Heavy eight.
Heavy eight, yes.
Joe?
An eight from me as well. I think, like I say, it just felt very uneven to me. And I think in particular, you know, you spoke about the last one working very well for you. The last one worked less well for me.
Yeah, that's the one I still am not entirely sure. Anyway,
yeah.
I can't remember which one it was.
It's the one in the coach. With all of them, yeah.
And it felt like it ended with more of a question mark than a pop. And so I kind of wanted to have that, you know, nice little full stop placed on the end of the anthology. But nonetheless, yeah, I agree. This can be pick and mix. I mean, I kind of wish there was a mini series on Netflix that you could just dip in and out of each one, because I see myself doing that in future. Rather than kind of sitting down to watch it in one sitting. But great stuff. I mean, these guys, you know, it's no risk. It's on Netflix, right? So sit down. If within 5 minutes you aren't feeling thoroughly entertained, then you've lost nothing. I can almost guarantee that within 5 minutes you will be, like the rest of us, giddy with excitement for what's coming next.
This ballad won my heart. 9. Solid 9.
Wow.
Yep. Love this movie.
And there's some, there's some of these stories which have these beautiful panoramic vistas.
Fantastic cinematography.
And the sound design is so good.
Costume.
Everything.
Production.
This is a masterclass in almost every aspect of movie making.
Yeah.
Correct. And so
we don't even like, generally, the three of us don't love Westerns, so...
Yeah, it's my least...
It's, I think, yeah, it's all not of, for all of us, it's our least favorite genre, maybe.
Or I don't normally gravitate towards Westerns at all, but the point I was making is that it just almost seems like a disservice to watch it on anything other than a big screen, but...
Yeah, you know, I mean,
be that as it may.
That's the heartbreak of straight to Netflix. I think, you know, I've said this before, but, like, you know, the movie theater is kind of like a second home for me. It's a place that's very special, and to enjoy movies outside of that environment is actually something I'm finding more and more difficult to do. You know, maybe it's because we do get the chance to see so many movies outside of it, but this is one, yeah, that's too bad that only the selected few will get the chance to see this on a big screen. Okay, move on then. Movie number 3 of the week is Widows. So,
okay.
Rashmi, take it away.
So, set in contemporary Chicago amid a time of turmoil, four women with nothing in common except a debt left behind by their dead husband's criminal activities take fate into their own hands and conspire to forge a future on their own terms. So, this is directed by Steve McQueen. Yes, that's Steve McQueen.
Well, not that Steve McQueen.
Of 12 Years of Slave.
Not that Steve McQueen.
That other Steve McQueen.
Yeah.
And it's written by Gillian Flynn, Steve McQueen, and one other person called Linda LaPlante, who Widows was based on, I think.
Yeah, Widows is based on a British comedy series, yes, television show.
From 2002, I think, or something. Anyway.
And by the way, that Gillian Flynn is that Gillian Flynn who wrote Gone Girl.
Ah,
the writer of Gone Girl.
That makes a lot of sense now that you said that yesterday.
Right.
And it stars, what a cast, Viola Davis, Liam Neeson, John Bernthal. We have Michelle Rodriguez. We have Elizabeth Debicki. We have Robert Duvall, Colin Farrell, Daniel Kaluuya. So many people are in this. Jackie Weaver. What a wonderful cast. And we started hearing a lot of buzz about this around Toronto Film Festival.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we couldn't get tickets because it was sold out immediately.
It was one of the first ones to sell out.
Yeah. So I'm very interested to hear what you thought of this. Yazdi, kick us off.
Steve McQueen, the British African-American writer, director, he started off with the movie called Hunger about the strike.
Yeah, the hunger strike.
The Irish
H Block prisons.
With Michael Fassbender.
He followed it up with Shame with Michael Fassbender.
Yep.
That was a brilliant movie.
Yeah.
It was a great movie about the sex addict, which also had Kerry Mulligan in it in a brilliant performance. And then he followed it up with 12 Years a Slave, which got a lot of Academy and Oscar attention and, you know, Best Supporting Actress wins and so forth. And so the last thing I would have expected him to take on as his next big project would be a remake, not a remake, but a film based on a British television show, which is very contemporary, which is, by all intents and purposes, a heist film. And it seemed like, has he sold himself? Has he commercialized? Why is he making a movie with Liam Neeson in it?
like me some Liam Neeson. Leave him alone.
Yes, yes. And my great surprise upon watching this movie is how he manages to keep his feet in both tents, right? He's keeping one foot in that mainstream movie, which is a full-out gangster heist movie with bad, bad, bad villains and, you know, these women trying to prevail against nasty men. And he has his other foot in this tent where he's being Steve McQueen, where he's doing odd things and kind of within that genre, kind of playing with it and kind of pulling our leg at the same time. And it may seem like a diversion on his part, but actually this is a very strong movie, and I like that he can get into a genre and kind of turn it a little bit from the inside out. I found the movie exceptionally satisfying. I was enraptured as I was watching it. I feared for people's lives. I was legitimately scared of Daniel Kaluuya in this movie. It has a great little twist at the end, which I did not see coming. It has a beautiful ending. And that last shot, we need to talk about that last shot in the movie, or maybe we don't. This is what great filmmakers do. They take a television show and they make gold out of it. This is gold.
You feel the same, Joe?
I found it very hard to get comfortable with this movie. And I say that because, like Kirsty said, I think on the face of it, this is, you know, an Ocean's-type heist movie. You know, we see the fun and games leading up to the heist. But it's something very different, too. And so I could never get to a point where I felt on balance. This movie kept kicking me from side to side in terms of enabling me to process what it was. And I think with that discomfort, I can... Did it take away from my enjoyment of the movie? I think it did, you know, by you know, maybe a point in this case. This movie was extraordinarily good. I think its plot twists and its characters and its moments will reside with me for an extraordinarily long time. Like, there is nothing... Again, like we talked about this with the Coens, but Steve McQueen also has... a particular feel to the way that he makes these films, right? And you feel the intelligence of the director in the way that he, you know, does his craft, and we very much feel that in this movie, because everything is so conventional yet unconventional. So the characters are surprising. They behave in ways that have integrity, but at the same time that are unexpected to us as viewers. And I think, you know, it keeps you on your toes. So I enjoyed it very much. I will say that it was not a comfortable experience for me, though.
Okay. So I agree with you both in terms of enjoyment. I think this is a really good, exciting heist movie. And we haven't had one of those recently, a good, really good heist. It's well acted, it's well paced. I think some parts are a little predictable. I did predict one part, but that doesn't take away from the enjoyment overall. And I did like the twist at the end too, Yazdi. I think Viola Davis is amazing in this movie. You know, we've only really seen her in period pieces or very high drama art, but it was really good to see a very contemporary before. You know, contemporary lead, which was very great. But the person that really stunned me and who was breakout for me was Elizabeth Debicki. She was amazing in this movie, and I really she was able to convey this character who is kind of someone who needs to be looked after and nurtured, yet has her head on her shoulders. So that was a great contrast, a really great character arc there. To your point, Yazdi, I think it has a lot to say about race, class, politics, gender. It's really got a lot here. And the dialogue is beautiful. Like, you kept listening to the dialogue and it felt really authentic. It felt very Chicago. You know, we talk a lot about New York movies. I haven't seen many real Chicago movies, but this while, really gave us a sense of where we were and what's happening in Chicago and the politics around that. And that was really clever. I really enjoyed this movie.
Can I just ask a quick question, Yazdi? In the screening that you saw, did they have the snippet from Steve McQueen at the beginning of the movie? Because when we saw
we saw a
regular screening at AMC, but they had this, you know, 30,
kind of a message from the director.
30 to 60 seconds saying, hi, I'm director Steve McQueen. This is my movie.
And he said it was a passion project.
Yeah. So I asked that only because I think the fact that this is a black director almost needs to be known because of the portrayal of the black characters in the movie. I don't know. I mean, I think some people may have taken offense in some ways at the portrayal of some of the black characters, you know, the Daniel Kaluuya character, but also the corrupt politicians and all of this. It's kind of, to me, it felt like it was very important for them to get across that this was, you know, an African-American, well, he's not African, he's not even American.
He's British, but a black
British director that made this, just to get that across, because there is real evil in this movie, and they're frighteningly evil.
And the violence is very brutal, but it literally, like, so made me jolt in my chair.
A regular following trailers, had this little intro.
We don't usually have that, at least when you commercially go to a commercial run of a movie to have, you know, an introduction by the director.
Yeah, it was lovely.
You've already paid the ticket. Why do you need to convince me now? I'm already here.
Yeah.
So
he was like, please enjoy my movie. And I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
And that's always a bad sign to me. That kind of makes me worried when I think we saw it last with A Whisper in Time or something like that.
Yeah,
with,
A Wrinkle.
A Wrinkle in Time.
I can talk. There's so many things, like you said, that we can talk about forever. In the screening that I saw, it was full with it was like they had to turn away a lot of people because it was a full screening. Were you there with
me? No, we couldn't make the screening.
And the very first scene, the very first shot in the movie is of Viola Davis and Liam Neeson in bed, and they're kissing. And there were people who were giggling at that. And it was so bizarre.
There was a lot of tongue action, which kind of upset me a little bit, but it's okay.
Was there?
But
I think it's very ballsy to have a movie open with a love scene between 50-some characters, one of whom is African-American and the other one is not. So I think he kind of make... You know, remember when we saw Nocturnal Animals. And the opening credits had this woman, naked woman dancing. Yes.
Naked fat woman.
It was the same thing in that he's warning you that you have signed up for something which is not going to be...
I never thought about like that. That's a great point.
It's not going to be like run-of-the-mill, you know, be prepared. And I like what it has to say about what's happening right now in the U.S., where race has become such a big issue. It always is, but right now with the whole political thing, race has become such a big issue. And, you know, even though this is a heist movie, at the crux of it, it's very Shakespearean in terms of there are these two clans. There's this political empire, of this very wealthy, rich, old school family played by Robert Duvall and his son played by a very, very fine Colin Farrell. And he's being challenged by this black...
up and comer politician,
and he is no saint either. I mean, he has his own issues. So in a way, it's this clash between races, which sets the foreground for the whole story. But then, even in the heist, I think Steve McQueen does a great job in terms of, in plain view, he's pulling a fast one on you.
Yeah, for sure.
In plain view, he is until you don't realize it. And there's a scene with the dog barking, which I was like, what? I was like, when I was watching, you know what I'm talking about,
right?
Exactly,
yeah.
And I was like pooping in my pants, and everybody in the cinema was screaming at it, open the door, open the door, open the door. And, you know, that's good filmmaking when you've completely invested in these characters and you are with them. So this is another fine, fine film, I think.
I don't know how we're going to choose amongst these gems that we're getting now. And we always say this, They all come at the end of the year. How do you choose? How do you choose between these great, these are great movies. They're really entertaining. Now, I was actually sat next to a couple who would not shut up. And it even shut them up in the middle, which was great. Like, it was that enthralling that I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to have to do that. You know, please, can you keep your voice down? But it even shut them up for a while, which was, I think, a testament of the movie, because they would probably talk through a funeral.
Yeah. And again, that's the great genius of the movie in the sense of it keeps pulling you in.
And it's mean.
And it's mm-hmm. it's mean, but again, you know, I'll go back to the theme of discomfort, which is it really has these constant reversals of fortune. You know, it's, you know, the heist, again, we see this in heist movies where things go according to plan, then not, then yes, yeah. then not, you know. But this movie, like, brings them in from left field, and in a way that has enormous integrity. You go, of course, forgot about this aspect. And this movie has a lot of characters to follow.
Yes.
I mean, that's the other thing to kind of...
I was kind of worried about that.
I was actually sitting there thinking, I can't imagine the writing process for this. There must have been sticky notes and post-it notes and folders and diagrams connecting characters to each other in all sorts of different ways. I literally just pictured this huge whiteboard with, like, all these connections.
Yeah.
Because, and again, the beauty in the filmmaking here is allowing us to follow all this mess of different things that are happening at different times that all come together in this wonderful way. So extremely well crafted.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, you were talking about Elizabeth Debicki, and she was, you know, she was originally in The Great Gatsby.
Yes.
The one that...
That's where I know her
from. What's his name? The Australian director.
Balthazar, something like that.
Anyway,
I'll Google him while you talk.
Yeah. So with Leo DiCaprio and Tobey Maguire and Carey Mulligan again. Why are you talking about Carey Mulligan a lot? Buzz Lerman, yeah. Buzz Lerman.
Thank you. Baz Lerman.
Baz Lerman. So he was supposed to be... That was going to be her coming out. And, you know, that movie didn't do exceptionally well.
Well, and she got overshadowed by Carey Mulligan.
Correct. And then she was in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Remember, she was the bad guy in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. And we completely forgot about how good
she's a chameleon.
And in this movie, again, it's a very difficult role. It's a woman who, like you said, wants to be protected by a man, but at the same time has no qualms about, you know, getting her claws out when there's a need for it.
Yeah.
And she almost, you know, the heist is conducted by five women, but, or maybe more. But at some point, it just becomes... about her and Viola Davis.
Yes.
And so it's amazing, you know, how well her character does. And again, talking about acting, we always expect Viola Davis to be good, and she's no less good here. She always seems very clenched through the whole movie, like she has to will things to happen because otherwise they will not happen in her favor.
Mm-hmm.
But again, Daniel Kaluuya, who we saw last in Get Out, playing this person who is reacting to all the strange things happening around him. He is our surrogate, and he moves so easier into somebody who I was consciously scared of.
He's a frighteningly
deadly character.
He doesn't have much dialogue either.
No. No. And see how much dialogue Robert Duvall has or Colin Farrell has. Jackie Weaver is there for three scenes, but she's memorable. There's a great scene in the movie.
She's scary.
She's very scary. There's a great scene in the movie where Colin Farrell and his wife get into a car and they have this conversation, which is very telling. And the car is tinted and you never see them talking.
Yes.
You just hear them.
You know what you see? You see the change, and you see the change in location, and you see Steve McQueen's opinion of how
women
money affords you different things. So we go from a very, very ghetto area and we move into the very rich, affluent area in one scene, and it's unbroken.
It's got the dialogue
in the back, and it's beautiful.
The structure of that scene was to give you the sense of the juxtaposition of the different neighborhoods and the different
From a craft perspective, it's done so beautifully.
Yeah, I know. And editing, I think, is another one that this movie,
yes,
when it comes down to awards,
yes,
because keeping track of,
yes,
all of this and cutting back and forth, again, I don't know whether I give writers or editors credit in the terms of jumping around in, yeah, the way that this movie does, but woo, so good.
So good.
So I'm going to wrap up and give this another movie with a very heavy 8. I so want to give it a 9 out of 10.
What is wrong with you? When are you going to give your 9?
I give a 9 to...
You're allowed to give more than one.
He's very stingy with his 9.
I'm very stingy with my 9s,
yes. He's impossibly stingy with his 10s. I don't think I've heard of one yet.
I've heard maybe give... No. Anyway, go on.
What's the point of having a 10 if you're never going to give it to anybody? It's like having an Olympic gold medal when no one can win the prize.
Yeah, but it's giving like 10 out of 10. But anyway, like 8.5 out of 10, which should be a 9 out of 10. But I love this movie. I can't think of a single person I would not recommend this to, unless if you're going to go. It's not a family movie. It's not a movie you go and see with your kids. But other than that.
Or your grandmother.
Yeah, or your grandmother. Just see it. This is the movie that, this is the movie that Ocean's 9 should have been. Although Ocean's 8.
Please don't will an Ocean's 9 into existence, Yazdi.
Okay, Ocean's 8. And it's gritty. It has a lot of things to say. It has some tricks up its sleeve. It's a great heist movie. You couldn't possibly ask for more.
Yeah. Terrific stuff. Unfortunately, an 8 for me too, even though I think this movie is better than that. And I say that simply because I feel like I need to see it again so that I'm not always in this place where I'm being knocked off balance by it. Because it really did. All the way through, I was like, oh, I should be laughing here, right? Because that was funny, right? And no one else is laughing. You know, I should be uncomfortable here, you know. And then comes a moment where, you know, it feels very conventional. And then comes a moment where a shot lingers on a character forever. And it puts me in a place of like, well, you know.
Why is this happening?
So it constantly had me... It's incredibly original. I don't think there's anything quite like it.
Well, I guess Widows, the TV program,
which I'm not familiar with at all.
Yeah.
Lovely stuff. 8 out of 10. I liked it an enormous amount. And again, I think this could easily rise on second viewing to something more special.
Well, I'm going to give it a 9 because I think it's a great thrill ride at the movies. It's a great movie. If you like movies, if you like cinema, go watch this. It's incredibly good. And best ensemble. One of the best ensembles.
Easily.
Yeah. No, this is on the Oscars 10 list for sure. I mean, I don't know that it's best director fodder, although I think it could be.
Oh, easily.
But I think that it's definitely on the top 10 list of Oscar movies. Okay. Let's wrap it up. We've been babbling for an hour. We'll be returning very shortly with reviews of Destroyer and If Beale Street Could Talk. Thank you for among the things that we're thankful. Thank you to you listeners for listening to Movie Wallers and for supporting us in this way. We look forward to talking to you again in the next one. So until next podcast, it's a goodbye from me.
And me.
And me as well.